From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats in Congress, including Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, are calling for Labor Secretary Alex Acosta to resign because of his handling of a 2008 case against Jeffrey Epstein, in which Epstein admitted to a prostitution charge. It was for sex with minors. And Acosta, then the U.S. attorney in Miami, cut him a light deal. Yesterday, Epstein was indicted on sex trafficking charges that date from 2002 to 2005. Interesting in that also today, investigative reporter Vicki Ward says she wrote an article about Epstein for Vanity Fair around that time, 2003. She says a mother and her two daughters told her Epstein tried to seduce the young girls, but that reporting was cut from the article by editor Graydon Carter. Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, is one of the lawmakers calling on Acosta to resign. Senator Kaine, make your case.
Well, Robin, I'm on the committee that interviewed, that had the hearing for Secretary Acosta when he was nominated, and I asked him about this horrible plea deal with Jeffrey Epstein, and I found his answers completely unsatisfactory. It was a sweetheart deal. Since then, it's been disclosed that it was an illegal deal. The federal court in Miami ruled that the plea deal was illegal because they hid it from the victims, which they were required to notify about the deal. And the thing that I found the most outrageous is in this massive allegation of sexual predation, sexual trafficking of young girls, Secretary Acosta, as U.S. attorney, cut a deal that let Jeffrey Epstein plead guilty to prostitution charges. These kids were not prostitutes. They were middle schoolers and high schoolers. They were sex trafficking victims. And by letting him plead guilty to prostitution, I viewed it as re-victimizing these youngsters. Alex Acosta is the Secretary of Labor. That's an enforcement job. He's supposed to be enforcing for workers, labor trafficking victims, often against very powerful people. And what he demonstrated as U.S. attorney is that he'd cut a sweetheart deal for the powerful at the expense of the people who needed his protection. He should not be Secretary of Labor.
Well, let's explain some of what you've just said. This deal, first of all, allowed Jeffrey Epstein to avoid a federal charge, which would have potentially meant life in prison. Instead, these were state charges. It included a year in county jail. But he was allowed to leave every day in a chauffeured automobile to go to work for 12 hours. Here's Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark questioning Acosta in the hearings you mentioned. He defended the deal.
The facts in this case were presented to a grand jury that actually recommended a charge that would have carried no jail time at all. And at the end
do
of
you
and
regret
at the,
making
and at
this the, deal in secret?
And at the end of the day,
do Ms. you regret making this deal
Congresswoman,
in secret?
Congresswoman, if I could finish. If at the end of the day, Mr. Epstein went to jail, Epstein was incarcerated, he registered as a sex offender, the world was put on notice that he was a sex offender, and the victims received restitution.
Senator Tim Kaine, there he is, Alex Acosta, at that hearing, saying, well, you know, he did have to go to jail and he had to register as a sex offender. But that brings to mind that, as columnist Michelle Goldberg writes today in the New York Times, there's plenty of blame to go around here. She writes that after he registered as a sex offender, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, under the Democrat Cyrus Vance Jr., inexplicably, her word, asked a judge to lower that level from 3, the most serious, to 1. The judge refused to do that. That sort of underscores that there were a lot of people in power who were, for some reason, trying to make life easier for Jeffrey Epstein, including the Democratic District Attorney's Office in New York.
Let all the dirty laundry be aired, Robin. I don't care whether it's a Democrat or Republican. This Epstein is a sleazy guy. He's a sexual predator. If people in power coddled him, then put it all out on the table. It was very clear to me when we had the hearing with Secretary Acosta in March of 2017 that, you know, it was he hid this deal from these young victims, and he labeled them and re-victimized them by making it a prostitution charge, and I want it to all come out in the open, and that's why I voted against him, and that's why I think Acosta needs to step down.
Well,
the last thing we need is a Secretary of Labor is a guy charged with enforcing powers who's got a history of protecting powerful people at the expense of vulnerable people.
This circle could be very wide. Bill Clinton was on Epstein's private plane many times. Epstein's so-called girlfriend, who some of the women say helped him procure young women was at Chelsea Clinton's wedding. Nancy Pelosi's daughter tweeted out, "This may take down some of our faves, but let the chips fall where they may."
I completely agree with that. Look, this guy is a sexual predator who has escaped justice. It looks like finally somebody's taken this case seriously.
What do you want to hear from President Trump? Pictures floating around of him and Jeffrey Epstein. They were very close. He once said, "I've known him for 15 years. Terrific guy. He loves beautiful women like me, only he likes the younger girls." I'm paraphrasing. What do you want to hear from President Trump?
Well, I think that's really important. There's accounts by other individuals that President Trump was a frequent visitor to Epstein at Epstein's house. And I think at least one of the individuals who has sued Epstein was somebody who was working at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. So I think there's a lot that should be asked of the president and people close to the president about this. But again, this isn't a Democrat or Republican thing. Whoever was involved in this, let's, you know, cast some sunlight on this thing and find out what happened and follow the story wherever it goes.
Senator Tim Kaine, thank you.
Absolutely.
Well, all Gulf Coast beaches in Mississippi remain closed today. The state's Department of Environmental Quality announced the closures over the weekend because of a toxic bacteria outbreak that can cause rashes, stomach cramps, and vomiting. The bacteria was caused in part by flooding along the Mississippi River. Professor Monty Graham is the Associate Vice President of Gulf Coast Research at the University of Southern Mississippi. Professor, what's going on here? Why is this bacteria outbreak happening in the Gulf?
Well, it's a freshwater species. When the Monticary was open and released the freshwater into Mississippi Sound, it went from a relatively salty environment to a freshwater environment. And so we've got a freshwater bloom of algae that's normally found in lakes, and that's where it typically causes problems inside of lakes and reservoirs.
And the Monticary is the spillway that was opened?
Correct. Now, the Monticary spillway, it was supposed to be opened once every 10 years, and we're seeing it opened annually. And this year, it's actually been opened multiple times.
Is that related to climate change?
Well, it's a good question. The Mississippi River catches a huge portion of the continental U.S. About a third of the U.S. Drains into the Mississippi River. So it's capturing climate. It's not just capturing weather. And so this repeated opening of the Bonnie Carey spillway is likely due to increased precipitation over the entirety of the Mississippi watershed.
So what are your concerns about this in the Gulf right now? We already know that this has been blamed for the deaths of dolphins and sea turtles.
Right. And we're seeing near 100% mortality of oysters in the western Mississippi Sound. Used to be an extremely vibrant oyster harvest area is completely devastated at this point.
Hmm. And obviously that is going to have a big impact on people who are in the oyster industry, but also with people not being able to go to the beach or not being able to go in the water along the Mississippi Gulf Coast, that's going to have a big economic impact as well.
That's probably the largest impact is going to be with tourism. This was supposed to have been the busiest weekend of the year here, and I live here, work here, and the beaches were extremely quiet this last weekend. So without a doubt, tourism has taken a huge hit.
Professor Graham, I remember last year there was a massive algae bloom off of Florida. Thousands of fish died, more than 100 manatees, among other animals. Is that connected? Is that part of the same thing?
Well, they're both harmful algal blooms in that sense, but the one that happens off of Florida is a marine species, so it's supposed to be in the ocean. This one is a freshwater species. It's not supposed to be in the ocean, and so that just gives you a sense of how big this freshwater event coming out of the Mississippi is, that we've actually got a blooming freshwater species mm-hmm. in a coastal environment.
If this is something that is happening year after year, what should be done about it?
Well, we're looking at technology that is from the 1920s. You know, when the Monte Carey spillway was opened in the early 30s, was in response to the 1927 flood. We've got a decision process that's about 30 years old as to how we're opening the spillway now in response to flood events. And we're looking at 21st century problems. And so this confluence of technologies and decisions and future problems, we have got to deal with this on a national scale.
On a national scale, at the federal level, you're saying it should be dealt with.
Absolutely. You know, the Army Corps of Engineers is the overseeing body for the Mississippi River, and it's a multi-state national issue and needs to be dealt with really at the federal level.
Meanwhile, in the current situation, how long do you think before this bacteria dissipates?
Well, we're looking at the development of a tropical storm in the northeastern Gulf of Mexico. So depending on the track of that this week, we're hoping that it will mix out. No, nobody wants a hurricane. Nobody wants a tropical system. But a good north wind right now would do wonders for clearing out the Mississippi River as they start closing the Bonnie Carey.
That's Monty Graham, who is the Associate Vice President of Research for the Gulf Coast Research Lab at the University of Southern Mississippi. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from EmberWave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. EmberWave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave, own your temperature.
So, question, what exactly is Iran doing? We know leaders in Tehran announced that as of yesterday, the country was enriching uranium to a higher purity than allowed under the 2015 nuclear deal. The UN nuclear agency has also confirmed that Iran has exceeded another limit imposed by that agreement, a limit on its stockpile of low-enriched uranium. But how close is the country to weapons-grade uranium, and how much of a stockpile does it have? And what about the deal, which the Trump administration pulled the U.S. out of last year, but Britain, France, and Germany are still signed on to? And today, they called for an urgent meeting. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst. He's with MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, urgent meeting, you think?
That's what Europeans do. They do urgent meetings.
Perhaps. So, you know, add to all of this, President Trump also ramped up pressure on Iran after its Revolutionary Guard increased the tensions by shooting down an unmanned U.S. drone last month. And so there's a boosted American military presence in the Persian Gulf, more sanctions on Tehran. We've got this vicious cycle. A meeting would seem to be in order. Talk first about the enrichment. Yeah. How much is it, and how does it compare to, you know, super enriched that you need for weapons grade?
Yeah, this is not a big technical thing right now. This is a political thing, not a technical thing. Mm-hmm. So going from 3.67% to 4 or 5% matters ultimately not at all. I mean, you have to have uranium enriched up to 80 or 90% to produce a weapon. And that's not what this is about. This is the opening chapter in what will be a book that in which a new chapter appears every 2 months. Mm-hmm. The big thing here is every 2 months, they're going to come back and make another announcement. And it might be more centrifuges, it might be better centrifuges, it might be enrichment at a higher level. But that's what we're going to get, drip, 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 every 2 months, announcements that are more consequential than the previous one. And that's because they've changed strategy. Before they were slow playing it, Iran is now pushing back and putting pressure on the president in the face of that maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. has.
Which has had an effect. I mean, the economy is in a spiral in Iran. But talk about the supply that they had. Some analysts are saying, thank goodness that President Obama and others crafted this deal, because the stockpile that they had that was fully enriched had to be shipped out. By the way, I always thought it was shipped to Russia. Are there any concerns there that Russia has all the extra enriched uranium from Iran?
I would say no, because Russia is a nuclear weapon state, the first or second biggest nuclear weapon state, and it's swimming in nuclear material. And so a little low-enriched uranium from Iran won't matter all that much. I would say, you know, it's important to step back as we enter this action-reaction cycle that will play out over several months and may lead to the use of force. Let's remember the big context here. The big thing to remember is that Iran can make a nuclear weapon if it wants to. That's what the director of national intelligence has said over many different presidents, that Iran already has that capacity. They can make a centrifuge. They've built 19,000 centrifuges.
And they can enrich the uranium up to 90% or whatever.
Yes. You know, if they decide tomorrow that they will pay any price, bear any burden, eat grass to do it, they can do it. What they haven't made is the political decision to do it. And so they're going to play around at the edges here with the centrifuges, with the enrichment levels, with the size of the stockpiles in order to pressure the Trump administration. And the question will be, how will the administration react? Will they seek diplomacy? Will they bomb those facilities, which in my view will lead Iran to make a nuclear weapons decision? How are they going to react? You know, the president didn't like it when he had to recertify that deal every 90 days, right? That got under his skin and eventually led him to try to kill the agreement. Now he's facing every 2 months the same thing. Only this time it's coming from the Iranians.
Well, but missing from all of this is, on the one side, Trump and the administration are saying, you were violating the deal even though, we just suspect you're violating the deal even though all the observers say they weren't violating the deal, and so we're going to impose sanctions. Iran is saying, we weren't violating the deal, and we're, you know, getting a little annoyed that we're being punished and we were staying with the deal, and in fact, you left the deal.
Exactly.
But missing from all of this is, if my understanding is correct, that what Bolton and others in the Trump administration are actually talking about is not the nuclear capacity.
Exactly.
It's the – well, tell us what they are.
Yeah,
talking about.
I think the main complaint is that they don't like Iran. And, you know, I get that. But there
and
are a lot
support of different
you know,
groups in the region.
Rap on them is, you know, they've supported terrorism. They're a meddler. They're meddling in Yemen and they're meddling in Iraq. And we don't like their regional behavior. And I've said all along, you've heard me say it 100 times, well, if you don't like Iran, the only thing worse than an Iran that does bad things is an Iran that does bad things and has nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And that's why we had a nuclear deal, to try to take that off the table. But that's no longer the case. It was funny last week, the White House issued a statement saying Iran had violated the deal even before the deal had started, which is quite a trick. I think right now the administration is in an awkward position where it's criticizing Iran for a deal that it says was the worst in history. So if it was the worst in history, why do you care that they are abiding by it or not abiding by it? But of course, Iran now can pretty much do what it wants because we sort of scotched the whole thing. You can't murder someone twice. But I hope Iran does. I'm worried about this phase, this new strategy for Iran of pushing back because it could lead to war.
Is there some backdoor way that some of the other countries, for instance, could ease Iran's economic issues with maybe the blessing of the U.S. and kind of avoid this?
I think so. Absolutely. In the U.S., there's talk about issuing waivers. If the U.S. simply, if Trump simply issued more oil waivers, that would take the volume down on some of this. But yes, there are ways to do it if the parties are willing to talk.
And, well, in the few seconds we have, there's a meeting being convened, and there's an election coming up in the U.S.
Yes.
So which is more beneficial? I hate to be that blunt, but which is more beneficial for the Trump administration? Continued war of words, maybe a war, or make this go away?
I think make this go away. I think they see that. You'll notice the president speaks often, the administration speaks often. I have not heard a single word in response to the announcements of the last couple of days. Not a word.
Okay. Jim Walsh, and what you're hearing in that speaks volumes. Jim Walsh, Here and Now security analyst, MIT Security Studies Program as well. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Let's pivot here to the recycling industry in the U.S., but more bad news. It's been a near collapse since China stopped buying recyclables from the U.S. almost 18 months ago. Now, domestic recycling centers are looking to rebuild processing plants to deal with the waste. As Heather Van Blockland of KJZZ reports, that requires a change in policy and millions in new funding.
Recycling has been an international business for the last several years, as U.S. cities have exported collected recyclable material to China. Since China stopped buying that material, industry advocates are now pushing for new funding from U.S. sources.
We're asking for $500 million over 5 years that would be appropriated to EPA, that EPA would then distribute to the states, and the states would then provide it to eligible entities.
David Biederman is executive director of SWANA, the Solid Waste Association of North America. Part of his job is to advocate for federal funding. Now that the infrastructure bill is dead, this funding ask is through something called the Recover Act.
You know, local governments are primarily going to want money for educating their citizens on how to recycle right, on not to put plastic bags in the bin. I don't think local governments are going to go out and get millions and millions of dollars. The funding simply isn't going to be available.
RECOVER stands for Realizing the Economic Opportunities and Value of Expanding Recycling, part of a long-term plan to end U.S. recycling's dependence on China.
I think that we're going to see continued reduction in the amount of recycling that is exported from the United States.
We already are. China dried up, Malaysia and the Philippines are also now refusing to take more from the U.S. Even Canada has sent material back. Cole Rosengren is senior editor for industry magazine Waste Dive. He says long-term, U.S. facilities face a fundamental shift in recycling operations, one that takes new funding and new policies.
Recycling is just hard. There's no federal policy. There's nothing in the books at the federal level to say how recycling should happen or where it should happen.
Because waste companies have exported recycling for so long, the U.S. has no recycling infrastructure to do the job here. No set standard from one city to another on what a recycling process is. No regulations, and nowhere near enough mills up and running to process the paper and plastic material collected every day. James Thompson is president of Waste Business Journal.
It's worth remembering that recycling, up until, say, 7 or 8 years ago, was a very expensive proposition. It came into strength in the early 90s as a result of what was believed at the time a crisis in landfill space.
So a lot of communities relied on the local private waste company to add on recycling services for trash pickup. And recycling was subsidized, essentially by the waste contracts, which became very profitable.
So, municipalities relied on the companies to create those markets and to bear those costs. And they did that by using the lucrative landfill contracts to help that.
The U.S. recycling industry has been built on a series of individual contracts. Increasingly, those contracts are owned and operated by the largest waste companies, Waste Management and Republic Services, according to Cole Rosengren.
They're still taking a hit financially, but a lot of them are doing stellar at the moment. You know, landfills are quite profitable. Waste collection, running trucks is very profitable.
According to Waste Business Journal, U.S. waste and recycling was a $74 billion industry in 2018. Publicly traded companies, including Republic Services, make up 60% of that industry, a percentage that is expected to grow over the next decade. And 21 domestic mills across the U.S. are on pace to be up and running by 2021. For Here and Now, I'm Heather Van Blockland in Phoenix.
Richard Branson's space tourism company, Virgin Galactic, announced today it is going public. This would make Virgin Galactic the first space travel company ever to be listed on the stock market. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. So Richard Branson is the man, of course, behind Virgin Atlantic, Virgin Records, Virgin everything.
Yep.
But what is the idea for Virgin Galactic?
So Virgin Galactic is one of basically three big companies, all headed by very rich
billionaires
that want to take people into space. Virgin Galactic is Richard Branson, who's Virgin Airlines, Virgin Records. He's a major British entrepreneur, and he has been dreaming about this for a long time. He registered the company in 1999, and he was expecting to have a spacecraft go into space this year. It may be the end of next year, this year, or next year. But what he's done is he has partnered with this other company, Social Capital Hedosophia, which is basically, they call them blank check companies. They're companies listed on the stock exchange that invest in non-public companies. So mm-hmm. Now Virgin Galactic is in a position to raise money from investors in the same way that Jeff Bezos's Blue Horizons can, or Elon Musk can. So that's what the issue is here. It puts Richard Branson into the game of being able to raise money on the stock market to accelerate his plans.
But accelerate his plans to, at what point are we going to start seeing people get on these things, whether it's Virgin Galactic or Blue Origin or SpaceX, and actually start going into space on a regular basis?
Well, the best guess is somewhere between 1 and 5 years, mm-hmm. right? A lot of them have still put end of 2019, beginning of 2020 as the date in which someone will get on a craft run by one of these companies and go into space. Now, that someone is not likely actually a tourist. It is a test pilot or something like that. As you know, Spaceship Two, which is Virgin Galactic's spacecraft that used to be, crashed on a test flight in 2014, killed the co-pilot, seriously injured the pilot. So they have to get past that, but they are very aggressively pursuing it, and very aggressively pursuing things that go past deadline means you need lots of money. So when you go into public markets, it means you and I can invest in these companies, and that's how they raise more. But somewhere between 1 and 5 years, you will start to see the first tourist on those planes. By the way, Richard Branson says he'll be the first non-pilot, non-crew on one of those planes.
Okay, but how tolerant are investors going to be of that kind of risk if there is an accident? I mean, I just think of what just happened with the 737 MAX and all the trouble that Boeing has had as a result. People are going to be scared maybe to invest in a company if there could be an accident like that.
Yeah, and so what they will tell you, and this is the conversation I had with Virgin Galactic after that 2014 crash, is that this is how airplanes got developed, right? There were crashes in the beginning, generally speaking. They don't hope for them, but they hope that when they happen, they're with crew and not passengers. But ultimately, you know, there were things wrong with the 747. There were things wrong with all of these planes. They're going to have to overcome that. But if and when it works, and ultimately technology being what it is, it will work, will regular people get a piece of the action, or is this just a game for billionaires? So basically, this is part of what Richard Branson is saying, is that regular people can get a piece of the action. Mm-hmm. Whether that's wise or not, Jeremy, is a different topic, whether you should be investing in these companies, but the idea is you'll be able to.
And we haven't even talked about the environmental impacts of all this, which is its whole segment all by itself to
have
these rockets going up. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
All this week, we're looking at different countries in Asia and how their relationships with the U.S. and China are changing. Yesterday, we checked in on Vietnam. Today, Pakistan. Joining us now is Shamila Chaudhry, a senior fellow at New America. Shamila, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, let's talk about how Chinese influence has been growing in Pakistan, because it's been growing pretty extensively over the last many years.
Indeed, it has. The Chinese have always had a very close strategic partnership with the Pakistanis that goes back several decades. But not until the past 10 years have they really increased their focus on economic engagement. And essentially what that economic engagement has enabled is a much closer partnership on many other levels. And so through Chinese investments in infrastructure development, power plants, building roads and a variety of highways, they've been able to build closer ties with the Pakistani military and increase their sales of military weapons. And the Chinese are essentially testing out some of their more exploratory military capabilities through this enhanced partnership with the Pakistanis.
Well, and one of the things that they've done is they've refurbished a port in Pakistan and then created a link from that port to China, because China and Pakistan border each other. And this is going to allow China to get goods where it wants them to go, and it's easier and cheaper than shipping them.
That's right. It's the most efficient route, frankly, for the Chinese to move things out of China. Now, the question here is who benefits from that? Obviously, the Chinese benefit from that immensely in terms of the economic opportunities. There's also a big kind of strategic military advantage for both China and Pakistan in the case of the Chinese taking over this port, and that is to strategically pressure the Indians, which, as we all know, have a tense relationship with Pakistan, and there are a variety of disputes between the Chinese and the Indians as well. And so this is an attempt, I believe, by both China and Pakistan to shift the needle a little bit on the question of India's regional influence and how it's perceived as more powerful and dominant over Pakistan. And it offers the Pakistanis more comfort that the Chinese are coming in now and rebalancing the Pakistan-India relationship, because right now the United States is absent from that. And historically, the U.S. has been the one that balances India-Pakistan tensions.
Well, and let's talk about the U.S. here, because the U.S. has had a relationship. It's obviously very close with India, but it's also had a close relationship with Pakistan, especially in the fight against terrorism. But the Trump administration came in and cut off a lot of funding, more than $1 billion of funding to Pakistan. What happened there?
Well, I think it's important to put the decreased funding from the U.S. to Pakistan in a broader historical context. It is very much a natural extension of the Bush and Obama era policies and frustrations with Pakistanis not delivering on war on terror expectations. Mm-hmm. And so I think regardless of who's in charge of the U.S. government, this was an inevitable outcome of working on kind of a war on terror that had a lot of kind of expectations undefined between the U.S. and Pakistan.
Well, and we remember that bin Laden was in Pakistan. He was hiding in Pakistan. And many think that the Pakistanis, at least some people in Pakistan, knew exactly where he was before the U.S. went and found him.
Yeah, and that idea is still very much out there. And I think it's a hard thing for both sides to get over. And so resentment politics kind of dominates the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. And it's consistent with the Trump administration's foreign policy overall. So I think that's to be expected. What's very interesting about what's happening right now is that this Chinese-Pakistan relationship and how that's not really impacting how the Trump administration looks at Pakistan. They actually don't really feel that threatened by all of the Chinese engagement in Pakistan. Part of me thinks that they're happy that someone else is doing it and they don't have to be responsible for it. But I believe that there's great risks associated with ignoring Chinese influence in Pakistan.
Well, because when the Trump administration pulled back some of that funding, very quickly thereafter, Pakistan made a deal with China to get some help with their military, right?
That's right. And this is something that Pakistan and a lot of the other countries in the region do, which is Pakistan is playing all sides because it's not in a position to make choices on who its benefactors can be. They are in an extreme economic crisis and, you know, the military wants money. And so the Chinese are happy to fill that space. And Pakistani political insiders will tell us that, look, the U.S. wasn't offering us what we needed anymore. Mm-hmm. And China was knocking on our doors. So we're gladly taking their help. But we're also open to others jumping in.
Now, the U.S. was in particular concerned about the war in Afghanistan and the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and getting help from Pakistan when it comes to the Taliban. The Chinese also have their own concerns about the Xinjiang province, which borders Pakistan, right? And they want to make sure that the Pakistanis are helping them in that case.
That's right. The Chinese have always had a very limited focus on terrorism when it comes to Pakistan and Afghanistan. They really just don't want these two countries, which are on their periphery, to, you know, spill over conflict and terrorism into Xinjiang, where the Chinese feel like they have plenty of problems to deal with. And so I think that the U.S. and other Western nations see that as an opportunity to get the Chinese to take more responsibility on broader terrorism issues. That's a high expectation of the Chinese. They tend to stay out of the politics of the countries they work on. But we have seen them start to engage a little bit more. For example, they want to be helpful in facilitating peace talks with the Taliban. And during my last trip to the region in just January of this year, a lot of Pakistani intellectuals felt like the Chinese might be the best country to lead the conversation with the Taliban instead of the United States. So I thought that was an interesting development.
So what are your concerns about this? You say that maybe the Trump administration is not taking it seriously enough how much Chinese influence is growing in Pakistan.
Well, with Chinese influence and economic engagement comes Chinese ways of doing things and essentially the exportation of tools of authoritarianism. So are they offering the Pakistanis tools of surveillance, facial recognition software, all these other kind of technological capabilities that could be then used against Pakistani civil society, against human rights activists, against Afghan refugees? I think we have to think about how then Chinese influence enables the Pakistani military in particular to pursue objectives that, you know, are not in kind of line with U.S. interests or values. Mm-hmm.
It sounds also like there is a little mistrust that is forming among Pakistanis about the Chinese investments.
There is. And I think, you know, the political hype surrounding Chinese engagement in Pakistan is something that's unavoidable for any government there. Pakistan is known to have extremely weak civilian governments, and each government has used foreign aid and assistance as a way to prop themselves up. You know, we have to look at how China is used as a domestic tool in a lot of the countries that it operates in.
Leaving aside the politics of it, because I think it would be very difficult for the U.S. to get something like this funded, do you think, as you look at what China is doing in the region and particularly in Pakistan, that the U.S. would be well served by doing its own sort of Belt and Road initiative around the world?
This is such a hard question, because the reality is that those kinds of activities, infrastructure development, loans that the Chinese give countries, you know, with undisclosed kind of terms, the U.S. doesn't engage in that anymore, mainly because they're party to so many kind of international institutions with norms and standards that are expected of it. And the Chinese can operate much more freely and quickly because they're not part of Paris Club and they don't have to answer to the IMF, or they're not a shareholder there. And so they're just much more capable at assuming risk. And the United States is not. And the best way to stay involved is for the United States to kind of complement any kind of Chinese activities that are happening on the economic side of things, and maintain strong diplomatic and foreign aid relationships with countries like Pakistan, so that at least American diplomats and military officials can have visibility into what's happening between Pakistan and China, say.
That is Shamila Chaudhry, who is a senior fellow at New America. Shamila, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll continue our series tomorrow with a look at the Philippines and how its president, Rodrigo Duterte, has moved closer to China. You'll be able to hear our whole series at hereandnow.org.
Electric scooters are all the rage, and in some cities, all the rage is directed at electric scooters. These are those stand-up battery-powered scooters that you rent with mobile apps and find wherever the last rider left them, and that now includes blocking sidewalk cafes and offending sensibilities outside tourist sites in Paris. E-scooters have grown in popularity across Europe since they first landed in Paris a year ago. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is editor-at-large at Recode. And actually, Kara, you were just traveling. You are now still traveling in a car, but you were recently, as you put it, zipping past the Arc de Triomphe, zut à l'heure, sailing along the Seine on a scooter.
Yes, I was. It was great. I loved it. You know, a lot of people have problems right now with scooters in Paris, which has seen an enormous rise in them. There's about 20,000 scooters draped all over Paris right now, which is a problem for many of the citizens there, because it's one of the few European cities who's really let a lot of different players in, and there's a ton of them, including the two big U.S. ones, and then many, many from Europe.
This is Lime and
Bird.
Lime
and Bird. Mm-hmm. And then they have others, and there was one called Vi. I didn't even know their names. They're just different things. So it's a really interesting scene in Paris, because I've never seen so much chaos and at the same time so much experimentation with different kinds of what's called urban mobility.
Well, as you say, 20,000 scooters in Paris now, estimated to be 50,000 by year's end.
Yeah.
And you've never seen, it's the most out of control scooter scene you've ever seen in a city. However, there's no better way to see the city. So put that together.
Well, it's a great way to do it. It's just nine or a dozen different purveyors of scooters. So they're all dropping them all over the place to see, you know, how to use them and how people are going to use them. At the same time, you know, Paris is like most cities, is heavily trafficked, and it's really hard to get around, even though the metro is amazing and it's a great way to see it. You want to actually see Paris. And so when you're on a scooter, you're moving more quickly because there's a lot of bike lines. There's a lot of people on sidewalks. There's a lot of sidewalk lanes. So it's a really great way to actually see it and travel, you know, in that last mile, from museum to museum or whatever you do. You can walk, obviously, which I do a lot of, but it was extraordinarily hot in Paris when I was there just a week ago. So that was harder. So, but on the scooter, it was just lovely just running around, and you could see everything while you were doing it. So it was fun, although I think it probably is bothering a lot of Parisians.
Well, it is. The mayor of Paris recently called this whole craze anarchic. The mayor of the 13th arrondissement started, publishing pictures of police removing these scooters when they're left, haphazardly blocking a sidewalk or, next to some, beautiful ancient tourist site. They're angry.
No, they can do that. It's just how they park them, and they have to park them correctly. And I think a lot of people are just getting used to it and not putting them in the right places, and there's just so many of them compared to most cities. I've ridden scooters in Washington, D.C., in Austin, in San Francisco, and it's just the whole question of what to do with sidewalks is really hard. And then, of course, people dying on them because most people don't wear helmets. Mm-hmm. And what do you do about that? And there's all kinds of issues, public safety issues. It has get sorted out, because this idea of urban mobility, cars in cities, as I've written many times, cannot continue the way they are. The traffic, the way to get around, it's a waste of energy. It creates a really bad urban environment. So people can't just walk, and obviously public transportation can't move fast enough to deal with all the people. And so there's got to be all these sort of innovative ways for people to get around. And this is one of them. And once they sort it out, it's a really wonderful way if they sort out the safety issues, the public, access issues, and maybe putting in lanes where these vehicles can ride, including bicycles. I was in Amsterdam, and there's no scooters there, but there's tons of bicycles. So it's just a really interesting challenge for cities as they're coping with the future.
Yeah. And by the way, you also went to London. Nice trip. Mm-hmm. Stricter laws, regulations that banned all sorts of things on sidewalks. It's
carriages.
Carriages.
Motorized carriages. Yeah. They've got an old law in place where scooters aren't allowed. And the city has, there's one area in the Queen Elizabeth, I think, Olympic Park, where they're testing scooters, bird scooters, but they're not allowed to have them on the streets there. Yeah. And so we'll see what happens, because every city, every municipality, just the way they've dealt with Uber or Airbnb are talking to these scooter companies, which are incredibly well-funded, and so they have money for lobbying and things like that. So that probably will change in London, and then I'll be, scooting around the London Bridge. So we'll see. They haven't come to New York City yet. Again, just like London, they're banned right now in Manhattan, but now I think they just signed a thing where they're going to be allowed in the boroughs.
Oh, I don't know about New York City and scooters. I'm not sure about that.
Oh, it's going to be in Brooklyn very soon. Brooklyn's definitely getting scooters. It's a question of Manhattan, they'll get them.
Something to think about before you travel this summer, if you're lucky enough to do that. Kara Swisher, still traveling, editor-at-large at Recode. Kara, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Jeremy, you have done much reporting and deep research on this. What do you think? Scooters?
Well, yeah, we've talked about it in a lot of cities like Nashville, which wants to get rid of them. But also, I did ride a scooter recently across Washington, D.C. And one of the things I realized is that it's very bumpy because the wheels are really small. They're much smaller than a bike wheel. So you go over a tiny little pothole and it's not very pleasant.
Here's what I know. Electric scooter, Robin equals emergency room. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.